You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, 93.9 Cable FM in Burnaby. You can also find us online at www.cjsf.ca, or you can call us at 778-782-CJSF.
How do we become a sustainable world? As the stakes for our survival continues to rise, so does our global consciousness. We are in the midst of a great spiritual awakening and are laying the foundations for a happy, peaceful, just, and sustainable world. With clear vision, determination, and a positive attitude, we are making sustainability happen. The transformation is already underway. You are listening to Sustainable Futures. You're listening to Sustainable Futures, and today we'll be interviewing cyclist Scott Stowell, author of Falling Uphill.
So I realized there's this progression that every human seems to be going through. First I survive, then I can start to wonder how to live my personal dream. And then there's like, well, even beyond that, I guess you could call peace, enlightenment, happiness, or whatever, or like totally redefining your whole life. And so that's the flow of the book right there.
You are listening to Sustainable Futures. So on today's episode of Sustainable Futures, it will be the second part of a two-part interview with cyclist Scott Stowell, author of the book Falling Uphill. Since the last episode, I finished reading his book, and I have to say it's a really incredible book, and quite honestly, it's really sticking with me. I just finished reading it a few days ago, and it's left me with a lot of impressions, a lot of really interesting stuff to think about. What's particularly interesting is the perspective you get reading his book and going through his adventure of cycling around the world. What's really remarkable about it is the way that he's written it that really brings you there and you're part of the journey, and it's, you feel like you're having these adventures with him. And you get this amazing perspective of what the world is like, because as he's cycling around, he meets all kinds of different cultures and different scenarios. And on top of it all, he's American. And this, he started cycling just after the 9/11 events. So he gets all kinds of flack by the prejudice people have for Americans, even though he is not representing America, he's representing himself, a human being. So it's that working out of relationships with different cultures, and on top of that, just a whole wide range of really interesting things about what it's like to cycle around the world. It's an extremely good book, and I recommend buying it. And this second part of the interview, in this second part, we're going to talk about cycling culture, some of the trials that he went through, some of the spiritual aspects of the journey, and the book itself. So here's the second part of the interview with Scott Stowell on Sustainable Futures.
What are some things that really struck you?
One of the big things was just the happiness of poor people.
Was interesting.
Was something that constantly amazed me. And also the resourcefulness of them as well to build something out of just scrap parts, mm-hmm. and make a life out of that, like just to build a shack or build little toy cars out of wire that would fall alongside the road and then sell these as sculptures to people that would go by. That was pretty amazing. People, of course. And then there's places that were equally amazing. You have your big tourist traps like Machu Picchu and the Parthenon, mm-hmm. pyramids of Egypt, of course, mm-hmm. But sometimes it was just like going around the corner and remember this place in Bolivia and just went around the corner and over a small mountain, and there was just these amazing like bad land formations with, I think they're called hoodoos, and mist and candy stripe mountains, and it was just amazing. It should have been in a guidebook, but mm-hmm. we were nowhere. There was probably no guidebook ever written about that area. I'm not mm-hmm. even sure we were technically on the map at that point. The map wasn't very good, and sometimes it was those mysteries and surprises that I really loved. Like when I went to Machu Picchu, I purposely didn't read the guidebook. I didn't have a clue what Machu Picchu was all about. It was culturally naive, and I kind of preferred it that way sometimes, so that it would be a surprise when I would get there. Mm-hmm. So those are a couple of the highlights.
Mm-hmm. And so you traveled with your friend the whole way, or?
That's a good question. I sometimes speak in plural, sometimes singular, when depending on the situation. Yeah. But we traveled for about the first 15 months. Uh-huh. Together, and then he decided to go home.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, he reevaluated his priorities, he said.
What was that like? That must have been a difficult moment.
That, and combined with some other factors, made Europe actually probably my most difficult spot on the trip, even though it was arguably the height of civilization, with good bicycle paths and food and
right.
and people and clean. Food was clean, water was clean, right?
Mm-hmm.
But just emotionally, I was just couldn't imagine. I was lonely, and I was suffered with a lot of boredom on the road, being in the middle of nowhere frequently. And then I knew Dennis was leaving. Yeah, that mentally was, and therefore physically, made it hard to pedal the bike. So,
what are some of the mental aspects of being on the road all day long? What did you find yourself doing a lot of soul searching?
Yeah, of course, that was kind of the basis of my whole trip.
Yeah.
But for the first 2 years, I was in survival mode generally, like food, water, where am I going to sleep? What words do I need to use to
right.
communicate? Left, right, forward, where's the welder? Things like that. But as I got a little comfortable with what I was doing, the soul searching aspect took over a little bit more. So I would think a lot on the bike. I guess I developed a real knack for daydreaming mm-hmm. and letting my mind wander. There are days in Australia that I just kind of wake up when I arrived at my next destination. I literally didn't really remember riding my bike that day. And I don't know if that's good or bad. It seems like I lost a day of my life to wandering around inside my head. I think that also shows the power of one's mind. So I tried to, and I still do as I ride now, try to train my brain to think in particular ways
mm-hmm.
so that calm those thoughts. And if I discover something that's bothering me, I have a little bit of a meditation or a contemplation, that process that I go through to try and root it out, ask myself, why is this a problem, or why I'm afraid of it, and essentially accept it.
Mm-hmm.
That seems to work I've tried fighting my baggage.
that
doesn't work. So, and then just ask myself if there's a better way of doing things. And so anything that I discover about myself that I'm not too keen on, I try to go through that process so mm-hmm. that at the end of the day I feel like I've achieved something.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the type of thing I would do. In the beginning of my trip, I actually read books of Spanish in Spanish, trying to teach myself Spanish as I was riding my bicycle. If that
right.
gives you an idea how boring sometimes the ride could be.
Right, yeah. But then that had practical value, I'm sure.
I don't think second language is my forte.
Yeah. So how did you deal with that? All of the different languages, having to communicate certain things.
Well, English, most people speak English, especially the young kids. And
uh-huh.
and I knew there were certain countries I went to that didn't really speak it. Like I stuck to the English-speaking countries in Africa because I don't mm-hmm. speak French, and
mm-hmm.
I picked up a lot of Swahili, though. There were certain languages I felt I was better at than others, and Swahili, I learned enough words to argue with the vendors in the market, or to or to hear them say charge the mzungu, that's their word for the white foam on the seashore, or a foreigner, charge the mzungu double. Like, no. Then I turned around and I said, no, I'm not paying that. I want to pay African price. And they said, oh, you speak Swahili. Oh my gosh.
Nice.
Yeah. So English, due to American and British colonization in the internet, or I should say a British colonization, American television and the internet, English is all over the place. Mm-hmm. So
it works out nicely then.
For us.
For us.
Yeah.
Yeah. Hmm. And accommodations, how is that handled?
Generally, I slept in my tent. Mm-hmm. Then anywhere I could. Hostels and hotels in some countries, depending on the... Like, Asia was so humid in the... I could barely stand my tent. It was like a sauna. Mm-hmm. And the hotel was like $9, would be a really expensive hotel. So I would get a hotel there. Or if it was unsafe, I'd get a hotel. Or in the cities. I slept all kinds of places. Cemeteries.
Oh.
Besides...
Cemetery.
Yeah, a cemetery. That. Interesting. Police stations, hospitals, next to fire stations. My favorite place, of course, would be like... out of sight, behind some bushes in a riverbank.
Mm-hmm. So it says on your cover that you had 50 countries, 6 continents, and 4 moments of enlightenment. Now, what are these enlightening things that have come across during this adventure?
Yeah, the other thing on the cover also is falling uphill.
Yes, falling up. Yes, the title of the book is Falling Uphill.
Yeah.
Actually, I was going to ask you about that too. How do you fall uphill?
Well, that's sort of one of the moments of enlightenment or peak experience, an aha. You could say we always have moments of enlightenment. We just are kind of missing most of them. So mm-hmm. I was luckily enough, I noticed about 4 up to that point in time. One of them was this back road in Mexico that was, again, probably not on any maps and a bit lost. And it was a rutted mountain road going up and around this, I guess I've said it already, it was a steep, rutted mountain road with big chunks of gravel and boulders, it seemed like. And it was so steep, I didn't want to stop, because I knew if I stopped, I probably wouldn't be able to get my heavy bicycle going again, and it would be really hard on my knees. So I tried to keep my momentum going, and I hit a rock, and I started to fall. But there were nobody else on the road, so I just kind of let myself fall with it, and then just pulled out just at the last second. So I kind of like fell into the danger. Just let myself go with it, and I couldn't get enough control before I hit another rock, and then I fell again, and so I started falling back the other way. And I did this like many times in a row. I almost went off the cliff once, but luckily hit another rock, and that one kept mm-hmm. me from going off the cliff. And I realized that I was actually falling up the hill. It was like as if it was like a ship tacking into the wind. I don't understand how a boat can tack into the wind, but that's how I felt. I felt like I was kind of cheating physics a little bit. And then I got to the top of this hill and I had this elated feeling, and then I coasted down the other side and felt as if I could just float down to the bottom. And so it was just an aha moment where I'm like, oh yeah, okay, I kind of felt like I was tuned in to the moment and realized I didn't have to fight everything all the time, and that I could actually ride my bike around the world if I could get up this mountain.
Right.
So those moments of enlightenment are hard to put in words, because I don't think we have words for these kinds of experiences, and a lot of people probably aren't really encouraged that in our society. So they're a little bit hard to explain, but they're always an aha, like an understanding or a discovery or a, it's like you feel like you're in a big balloon and somebody pops the balloon.
Mm-hmm. Now, was there an element of faith that you gained from that? Just the way you were describing it, that you just let yourself fall and see where it takes you, I guess.
Yeah, I'm not sure how I feel about that word faith. I think it has value, though. I've always wanted to just know it for myself. I've always wanted to experience something directly. Mm-hmm. I didn't ever want to have faith in something. But except for maybe myself, I guess I'm learning to have faith in myself, and that these kinds of experiences do give you a sense of an emotional foundation to let you go on and to the next mm-hmm. thing you want to do with your life. So I guess I did get some faith.
Right. Okay, and what are some other big revelations?
Some other big revelations? It's so many. The biggest one, I guess, is that, I don't know if I'm giving away the ending of the book here, or the ending of my journey, or the ending to the radio interview. But hopefully the people listening can follow along and have their own adventure of discovery based on what I'm saying here. And one of the biggest realizations I had was that I'm just kind of, there is no secret to life. Mm-hmm. Right? And the secret is inside of you. And I don't know if that comes out sounding really cliche and flat, but it took me many years to be able to get to this point, and I'm still working on it. And in other words, I believe the meaning, I found, let's say, a creative, I had a moment, another moment of enlightenment of there being like a creative force, let's call it, to the mm-hmm. universe. And I'm one of those creative forces, and there's probably many, and maybe even one big one. And mm-hmm. And so you could say the meaning to life is just simply to create and be joyful, and sometimes suffering's maybe part of that process, or at least your point of view may interpret it as suffering. And so that, I guess, gave me a little bit of faith also. Mm-hmm. And so my discovery was that if I don't like my life, I can make a new one. I can create a new one. I'm the one who created those rules in the first place. Mm-hmm. And I was helped by my, as I mentioned earlier, parents, government, religion, school, society, all helped create those belief systems inside of me. Or I got to the point, and I don't know how long, if it must be a lifelong process, but it's that questioning, where did I get that belief? Is it an accurate belief? And do I want it? Is it useful? Mm-hmm. So that was kind of my big discovery that's been still ongoing, is just rewriting the hard drive, so to speak. And you see that when you travel everywhere you go. They have different language, different culture. They do everything differently. You're kind of wondering how they're even surviving sometimes. They're eating, they're sleeping, they're dreaming, they're defecating sometimes, like not where you would think they would defecate. So we have a real basic things in common, right? But all the other stuff, it's just an added layer of meaning, right? It's their interpretation. You have to eat, but right beyond that, you know, you could be a violin player or a canoe, or you could be angry or happy, or emotionally childish for your entire life, or a wise old man. Like, all these variations of humanity are just everyone's dream. Sometimes, I guess, a nightmare if you're not really feeling like you're in control of your meaning of life. Mm-hmm. Right? And I thought, oh, well, I can give myself a new meaning. You know, I'm not liking the one I got now too much. Another word for what I'm talking about might be like cultural lies, right? You tune into the television, for example, and it's telling you, you know, what to wear, what to eat, what it mm-hmm. looks like to be successful, what it looks like to be happy, what a relationship is, and what that person should look like if they're looking like the kind of girlfriend that you think you should have if you're successful, right? So you're seeing this all the time being reinforced, like what your dream should be. It's interesting to take a time out and just look like, well, why is it like that? And that's what traveling the world gave to me, I guess, is just the awareness that the culture shock, you might call it, when I mm-hmm. came back to America going, oh my God, look, what are these people doing? I'm surrounded by zombies. So I went and I went to the video store. I started renting movies about zombies. My first discovery renting zombie movies was because I had this theory that, you know, movies are reflecting society's consciousness. And the first thing I discovered was there's dozens of zombie movies being released every year, not just like mm-hmm. one or two, but there were like dozens. There's like, there's whole movie mm-hmm. companies devoted just to zombie movies. Mm-hmm. So I thought, oh, this can't be good for society.
People can relate to being a zombie.
Yes, they are.
So with exposure to all these different cultures and different ways of doing things, that is definitely a very fascinating concept. So you're saying that when you came back to the States, did that feel like a foreign culture by that point?
Yes. Yeah. The most foreign one I had ever been to by leaps and bounds, definitely. Wow. Yeah. So, where do they say there's a saying out there somewhere, you're not done traveling until you go home.
Right? That's a good one. I like that.
I kind of made that up. But.
That's good. I like it.
There's got to be a somebody out there must have said something.
Somebody
like that.
Somewhere put quotations around.
Yeah. So that's the final cherry on the ice cream sundae, going home. Uh-huh. There are travelers out there, and you meet them. They're perpetual travelers and like perpetual students. They never mm-hmm. seem to graduate from traveling, and it's hard to go home.
So when you're getting towards the end of the trip and you finally made it, what was that like?
I had so many emotions that week. It was just up and down and sideways, and I felt like a prince of the universe, and sometimes I felt like a toad. So and no princess to kiss me. And my emotions were all over the board. You know, I felt great to have actually accomplished something that I thought was impossible. Mm-hmm. And I also felt like I was still missing something. Mm-hmm. So,
at what point in the journey was Canada? Was that like if you started in the States and you went south, then Canada must have been the last place? Or
I'm traveling again, so I'm here now.
Yeah.
But I did. Canada was part of the coast to coast, border to border. So,
oh, okay.
So I went through Vancouver on my what I call my warm up.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
So.
You are listening to an interview with Scott Stoll, author of the book Falling Uphill on Sustainable Futures. CJSF 90.1 FM. www.cjsf.ca.
One thing that I thought is kind of interesting is on bicycle culture. What are your feelings on bicycle culture, and what are your observations of people around the world and their attitudes towards bicycles?
Clearly, bicycling is bad for the environment, gives people horrible attitudes, and really just kind of get in the way of cars and transportation in general. Yeah, I'm being somewhat facetious. I wish we lived in a bicycle-friendly world so we could all get on the roads and feel safe and comfortable and get our exercise at the same time, but that's just not how it is. Other European cities are pretty great for bicycling. America, for example, is just not built to accommodate a bicycle. And it's great to see that this green thing kind of catching on finally. Mm-hmm. I mean, it seemed kind of obvious to me all along, and I've always lived that kind of green lifestyle. I went to school university 20 years now almost. I started, and I was kind of proud to have invented a tradition. I used to watch the people rummage through the garbage cans to get the aluminum cans, and they were usually pretty poor people or sometimes these old retirees that would just root through the garbage to get the cans out that the students would throw away. And I just I just started putting my cans on top of the garbage can because there was no recycling then. And so I would just, I said, why do we have to make these poor homeless and retired people root through the garbage? So I put the cans on top, and I think that was my first, I think I started a major trend because it wasn't that long, a matter of weeks, and everyone seemed to be doing it. So I don't know if that's a tangent or not, but so bicycling has always been part of my idea of like making the world this perfect place. But unfortunately, I didn't think biking is the solution people think it is. If perhaps nobody drove a car or the cities were built differently to begin with, maybe bicycling would be a better solution. It certainly is a good step in the right direction, but bicycling, like, for one, you eat a lot, right? And I, on the average day, bicycling 6,000 calories. That's a lot of food. I had this idea, another idea years ago, to do this, like, I called it like a eco-label footprint. I think this idea started to get really popular too, although this, I'm not the first one to think of this idea. I thought I did, but it's actually been out there in the ether. But I had this idea to put like a label on food to show like how far away it originated,
right,
what was actually in the packaging, and in like how much water did it take to grow the plant, how much oil did it take to run the machines and to drive the delivery trucks, and what kind of chemicals and fertilizers and pesticides were they using? What's in the label? And the metallic ink, those are difficult to manufacture and poisonous and seep into the landfill. And just, you know, what exactly, what kind of non-renewable resources were in this product beside the food, right?
Yeah.
And so I did my research on the internet, and the lady in the Australian Parliament even liked my idea and wanted to present it to them. And I had some interest there from like some graduate business students. And I don't know, I hope that I didn't, probably should have patented it and tried to make a fortune, but maybe it's out there in the universe and that'll make a difference. My point is that I realize there's enormous cost to food. And like 9 gallons of water and like a gallon of oil for one can of corn. And those numbers aren't right, but that's the thing. I was getting that feedback off the internet. And I thought, even if these numbers are half true, it's taking tens of thousands of calories to provide you with a couple hundred calories worth of corn and nutrition. So that kind of just cascaded into this whole thought that, well, maybe bicycling's not so good for the environment because you're eating more, you're taking hot showers, you're drinking beer. Like a lot of people, and some of them are vegans and vegetarians and things like that, are buying these packaged food in the, that come from like Alaska or come from Japan or... Right. And I thought, oh, this just, even if you're a vegetarian, that can't be good. What are your motivations for being a vegetarian or a vegan? Isn't it better to eat a cow next door than to be a vegetarian and eat tofu from Japan? So I started thinking of the costs of everything in my day-to-day life. And maybe this is something Canadians do on a regular basis, but where I came from, I was just kind of new to me. You know, another thing, my dad taught me many years ago, he's an engineer and a bicyclist, and I was a bit shocked to hear him say one day, a bit irate at this bicyclist, like holding up a line of traffic. And I was like, well, Dad, where do you expect the bicyclist to go? And he said, this guy thinks he's doing the world a favor and that he's saving money by riding his bicycle to the grocery store, getting some exercise, but he doesn't realize the cost, indirect cost of gasoline, of everyone lined up behind him. Oh. So there was like 5 or 10 cars in line, and we went around rather politely, but there other people would just, you know, come to a screeching halt and then accelerate around to make a point, and squealing tires and all that. And and so it quickly became obvious that this bicycle was consuming far more energy indirectly than a car would, just simply going down the road at a normal rate. So I think I mentioned, maybe I got distracted, but, you know, I like my beer and hot shower at the end of a bicycle ride, right? And
beer's an important thing.
And most bicyclists want to look good, so they buy the fancy bike and the fancy clothes, and then that means they probably have a car and a bicycle, right? And the fancy clothes and the shoes, which they don't.
Right, which is kind of defeating the point.
Right, a little bit. So there's all these hidden costs to everything we do. Mm-hmm. And hopefully somebody out there smarter than me can figure out a way to integrate in this bicycles into the society, mm-hmm. or phase out cars, mm-hmm. a bit more, so that it's just easier and to ride a bike, and that nobody's lives are in jeopardy. What about the cost of falling off your bike? That's pretty high. I mean, I've broken my arm. That cost a lot of money and...
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so you're taking wider perspective to get sort of those hidden things that people aren't really thinking about.
Well, and also I figure if I can create as much controversy as possible, maybe it'll make a difference, you know.
Yeah.
It's like people don't understand very well, get on our bike and live a long and healthy life and save the planet. I mean, if living a long life is actually helping the planet. but I mean that kind of benevolent, nice, feel good type of message doesn't really get across as much as maybe bicycling is just bad for the environment. We might reach more people.
Right.
It might have hopefully the opposite effect.
Well, it inspires people to exercise their brain.
Yeah, it's my reverse green psychology.
Yeah. Well, it's definitely like got me thinking. Like, so I guess if you're on the road, you really are going to have to eat whatever you come across. In which case, you are kind of, I think that is that part of your point? What you eat is sort of out of your hands sometimes, and you just don't know how local you're getting something or other factors that go into it that you mentioned.
Right. Well, in developed countries, you can get anything anywhere, anytime. And like the grocery store in London just amazed me. I was like, oh my gosh, I didn't think even the kings and queens of all time put together had these many options of what to eat.
Mm-hmm.
And generally speaking, in third world countries, they're pretty green, mm-hmm. by not having a choice.
Right.
So I would pull up, and they would go out in the backyard and kill a chicken and cut up a potato and fry it, and that was my dinner. Mm-hmm. You could say, oh, well, maybe that's not green. There was cost to that, too. Like, they had to chop down the tree to fuel the fire, and there just simply weren't enough trees to cook meals for everybody that wanted to have a meal,
mm-hmm.
Much less a bath. But I would eat locally and eat whatever they grew there. And like a can of tuna, I would like to have the protein, and you just throw that in your panniers and bring it with you to your campsite at the end of the day was kind of nice.
Mm-hmm.
But a can of tuna would cost, relatively speaking, the same or more as an entire meal, 3-course meal and a soda in a restaurant. So it's like they couldn't really afford not to be green because it was just cost them too much.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't really consider myself a vegetarian or anything like that, but I do think it's smart to eat locally and seasonally, like I did on the bike trip. So mm-hmm. that impact that I had that way was pretty, probably a small impact in a place like Zimbabwe with, right?
I'm really interested in what you're saying here, and it's also, you kind of seem to be, and of course you're going to have lots of opportunity to correct me if I'm wrong, you're making it look like, you know, sustainable behavior is really not just doing one thing. It's more of a way of being. It seems like you're conscious about every decision, and you're looking at, you know, what goes behind that? What are the secondary effects? Is that sort of an argument that you would make?
As far as I'm understanding you, I mean, yeah, there's no solution. It's not simply recycle, reduce, reuse.
It's a kind of consciousness.
It's like a whole, yeah. I mean, there's so many factors to our society. It's just reducing isn't enough. You know, you have to remove the problem almost. It's, can't quite recall, but I don't think we necessarily live in a sustainable world. I mean, just being human is not really sustainable, not with this population that we have now on the planet. And I'm not an authority, so I'm kind of repeating rumors, but I've heard that if we were to stop using pesticides and fertilizers, that there would be mass starvation on the planet. And certainly if we didn't have the oil and the trucks to bring them the food to us, there would be some starvation going on. So it's like the problem's pretty, if it's a problem, it's pretty huge. It's like there's just maybe simply too many people on the planet to sustain, you know, just feeding everybody. So a lot of things have to change, and I think it's gonna be like occupy every aspect of your life, and it can be fun. I don't think it has to be a burden. And there's a lot of things that I just don't feel I have time to think about or do, but hopefully it'll happen before it has to happen, right? Mm-hmm. Like,
yeah, and something like with the fertilizers and things that get stopped, all of a sudden it does have to.
Consider this for a moment. It's another idea I had a long time ago when I was a little kid. I asked my mom, like, well, Mom, where does all the oxygen come from? Mm-hmm. And she's like, oh, the trees make more. I'm like, well, what about the cars? Don't they breathe all the oxygen? And she said, no, don't worry. You know, the trees will make more. And I mean, I thought about that, and it didn't really seem possible that there could keep up with a tree could keep up with a car. And I think one of the things that's now starting to come out is that maybe there's not so much oxygen as we think there is, right? Mm-hmm. And you can, you know, they've measured it, and it is dropping. So it's like, well, I think things are going to change pretty dramatically when people start having a problem breathing.
Breathing's pretty important.
Yeah, well, you know, that might solve the problem if everyone stops breathing all at once.
Now let's talk about your book. So you're on a book tour now. That's what you're doing.
Yeah.
And are you traveling through North America once again?
I'm attempting to circumnavigate North America on a bicycle to promote my book. So we were on a little bit of the tangent of some of my theories about the environment, but yeah.
No problem on this show.
Well, my basic theory is just to tackle that problem just by shifting consciousness. My theory is, a lot of times people ask me if I'm doing this for like a charity or something, and I usually say I'm the charity, but I mean, that sounds like a joke, but really, I mean, I feel I have an important timeless message of, call it self-actualization, or just or living your dream, so to speak, or just being who you really want to be in life. And so that's what my book and my journey's about, more or less, is just to hopefully give people that hope, at the least, that, you know, they could kind of do what they want. And that if everyone kind of starts living a more aware and fulfilled life, that was going to provide the opportunity for all kinds of things, like maybe having that garden in the back, having the time to grow your garden in the backyard, right? Mm-hmm. Time and desire, right?
And what went into the book? You know, was this the result of notes you took along the way, or was a book always part of the plan, or is this something that happened you thought about later or during the trip?
It was always part of the plan, but pretty much for the first 2 years, I didn't think I'd really be able to accomplish. I wasn't really sure I had a story to tell, but I always took notes.
And how long has it been since you actually finished?
It's been a number of years since the physical part of the trip finished, right?
Yeah.
But it's kind of only been a few months since maybe I feel like I put some emotional closure on that trip. And so, and so some of those final chapters are about like culture shock and and redefining myself and who I want to be in my next dream and some of the things we've been talking about.
The book's called Falling Uphill. Now what can people do if they want to get a copy of this?
Basically, you can get it ordered at any bookstore or online on my website. I have a website called thearganauts.com, thearganauts.com, or Falling Uphill Book might be .com, might be easier to remember. And there are other ways.
Is that another site?
That's linked. It's just easier to remember. FallingUphillBook.com. And there are other ways to get it that a creative person will find that I care not to mention. but I encourage people to order from their local independent bookseller.
And maybe if you can give us just a description of the book. What will people experience when they read the book?
Hopefully people will re-experience or reimagine my trip. I've taken a lot of effort to write it in a way that people can actually feel like they're the ones on the adventure and discovering things moment by moment as I do, kind of written first person present tense. And the book is a series of short stories that can be read in separately, but they kind of fill up the big picture. And one of those discoveries that I did make was that people asked me the same questions everywhere I went, right? And it used to kind of irritate me to have the same conversations over and over every day. Like, how many tires did you go through and how do you ride a bicycle over the oceans and things like that?
Oh, right.
Your father.
I was going to ask you that.
All right.
How many ride over?
Yeah.
Must have a very good breath.
Extra air in the tires. And so one of the discoveries I made was that like I was in Kenya. Well, I was in the border of Kenya and Tanzania, and I saw some Maasai tribesmen, one of the few tribes that still practice a relatively authentic indigenous lifestyle, and they were just wandering through the bush in their bright red clothes, and they saw me and we started talking. They spoke a little bit of English, not great English, and they started asking me the same questions. So I asked them some of the same questions, like, well, where are you from? And they didn't know. I'm like, are you Kenyan? They're like, no, we're Maasai. I'm like, okay, you're Maasai. Do you live in Kenya? No, we're Maasai. I'm like, well, how about Tanzania? No, Maasai. So there were Maasai warriors. That's all they really understood. And I realized, like, wow, they don't have an affiliation to country even, but they're still asking me the same questions, right? And so it kind of had been formulating anyways, but I realized that there was a pattern of questions that people would ask me, the same questions in a similar order, and it usually started out kind of in survival. Who are you? Where are you going? What are you doing? What do you eat? Where do you go to the bathroom? How do you sleep? Do you ever get in any major traffic accidents like that? You know, that kind of stuff. And then it would progress to more like questioning how they could do it, like what are the logistics, you know, how much does it cost, where are you going, you know, this weather problem, things like that. And then I don't know if it was a factor that as I was ending my trip, see, when I began, nobody believed it was possible, or that a guy like me, overweight Midwestern culturally illiterate guy, could do something like this. So there was a lot of skepticism, but eventually people started to ask me questions like, what did you learn, or what's the meaning of life, or did you find happiness, or did you find like some kind of answer or God or whatever you call it. So I realized there's this progression that every human seems to be going through. First I survive, then I can start to wonder how to live my personal dream, and then there's like, well, even beyond that, I guess you could call peace, enlightenment, happiness, or whatever, or like totally redefining your whole life. And so that's the flow of the book right there. Starts out melodramatic, stories of being nearly trampled by elephants and thrown in prison, to moments of enlightenment and unenlightenment.
It's very interesting. So you're taking like the questions and then you're turning them back into what people think about first, in a sense. Like, people would ask you about survival first, so that would be their first concern. Is that sort of how you're interpreting that?
Yeah, exactly. So back to the meaning of life. If somebody asked me, you know, how many accidents did you get in, or what was the worst thing you ever happened to? That was a popular question. What was the worst thing that ever happened? And I kind of knew that their meaning, their belief, the lie they're telling themselves, or the construction of their brain or culture or parental upbringing, or however you phrase that, was, you could say, somewhat negative bent, or immature, maybe even like sophomoric or melodramatic, or
because someone else could ask, what's the best thing?
Exactly. What was the best thing that ever happened to is a much more rare question, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so based on what the first question anybody ever asked me, I could kind of put them on a spectrum, right? So I do the same thing. I meet people doing things, and you know, I usually seem to fall kind of in the middle, usually. Like, I gave a hitchhiker a ride for the first time, and I started asking him how he did it, right? That was all I kept asking. It's like, how do you do it? What do you eat? How much do you carry? How much does it weigh? Where are you going?
Mm-hmm. Well, I wonder if that ties into the basic survival instinct, which is what we all start from.
Yeah, I think so. I think we're all human, whether we like it or not, and you have to survive. We're in a world that requires eating, and eventually, hopefully, you reach a level where you get to eat what you want to eat, right? But I mean, you start out in need, like just pure need, and I think we all want more than that. I know we all want to achieve the most that we can achieve and feel like fulfilled humans and people, are with successful careers and family, strong family values. You know, I know that we all want these things. They manifest in different variations, as example by traveling around and seeing all the different cultures. But we all want this. We all want to live really, really good, productive, joyful, creative lives. And the problem for me, and I suspect most people, is we just don't think we can. Mm-hmm. And I think maybe even are encouraged not to. So,
mm-hmm. Why do you think we're encouraged not to?
It's a big question. I try to keep it simple. But basically, a lot of people view the world as a competitive place. Mm. And a lot of people's definitions of surviving are based on turning other people into their slaves, whether that be money or producing something or just ego gratification. It's like there's whole cliques of people out there that have these social hierarchies of ego gratification, and the person at the top of the pecking order is the one that gets the most attention, right? So I think that I wouldn't go so far as to say that's just human nature, but I would say that it's been so ingrained through our culture that that's what we think we need to do. Whereas I like to think that there's room for everybody in the world to do what they want, and everybody can be happy. And if one person's joy in the world is to travel and write a book, another person's joy in the world matches and give them a radio interview, and there's another person listening to the radio interview, or you get the idea.
Well, sounds like you've got a lot of really interesting things to read. I look forward to reading it myself. You definitely sold my readership. Is there anything else you wanted to talk about here while we're on Sustainable Futures?
Well, I would just say I'm out there on my adventure again and promoting this book and writing a sequel. And you know, I guess I just like to say, you know, I've realized I'm kind of in the same boat. So I have a lot of time to think on the bicycle, and I, you know, I have my ideas, and don't take anything I'm saying too literally, but, you know, investigate perhaps some of the discoveries that you've had here listening to what I have to say, and just keep in mind that, you know, I don't really know what I'm doing. And people kind of think that riding a bike around the world, I must be rich or must know what I'm doing or must be extraordinarily brave and intelligent. But the fact of the matter is that I don't really know what I'm doing. And I make lots of mistakes and have more doubts than I know what to do with, and sleepless nights. And but I'm discovering, and I'm living on the edge. Close to the edge is maybe a little bit too close, but that's part of the process. You know, I think anybody who wants to take their own adventure, whatever that may be, getting that job in a corporation, or taking an adventure, or being a gardener or a baker, or whatever that is, just, you know, it's part of the process to discover and have fun as you're going along. And that even if you do something like ride a bicycle around the world, and that last day is nothing special, really. It's the same as any other day. Mm-hmm. And you're still stuck with yourself at the end of it. So
it's a very important lesson. I was expecting you to be like floating.
Oh, well, after this, I'm going to go home and turn some water into wine and watch a movie.
Sounds good. Got to get some water out here, see if I can put you to work up here. All right, well, thank you very much. It's been a joy having an interview with you, Scott.
Okay, thank you.
So this is Scott Stoll, and he's got a book called Falling Uphill. He's on a book tour, on a bicycle book tour around North America.
To the east side, hey, hey, don't wanna do it on the inside, hey, hey, burning time in a traffic line, hey, hey, burning gas, where's the parking sign, hey, hey, it's too far for me to walk, hey, hey, it's 5K and then a block, hey, hey, I know a better way to get there, hey, hey, with no cab or bus fare. Got a bicycle, I ride around. It's the sweetest way to get to be I found. I got a bicycle, I ride around. I'm like Supergirl, I never touch the ground. Hey, hey, some days I'm going super fast. Hey, hey, and there's cars stuck in a mass. Hey, hey, and I feel super kick-ass. Hey, hey, as I squeeze through and fly past. Hey, hey, and I wonder what they're thinking. Hey, hey, as they're sitting there and stinking. Hey, hey, I hope they're thinking, holy shit. Hey, hey, I should get a bike and use it. I got a bicycle, I ride around. It's the sweetest way to get to be I found. I got a bicycle, I ride around. I'm like Supergirl, I never touch the ground. Every day in this city I'm living in, there's the potential for going crazy, but I'm not giving in, 'cause I found
That song is called Bicycle, and it's by Coco Love Alcorn. And the intro song that introduces each show is by an artist called Moira, and the song is called Like a Mountain. So I hope you enjoyed this episode of Sustainable Futures. If you want to check out that Scott Stoll book, once again, you go to his website, www.thearganauts.com, or Google the name Scott Stoll or Falling Uphill, and you might find that easier to remember. So thank you for listening to Sustainable Futures. All episodes of Sustainable Futures are available at the website www.radioforall.net. That's the number four, radio, number four, all.net. And I update that periodically to put all the most recent episodes. All 35 episodes will be there. This is the 35th episode of Sustainable Futures. Thank you for listening, and I am wishing you a sustainable future.